countdown for the voting for the Australian Podcast Awards has begun. If you haven't voted yet and would like to get behind Fallon, you still have a chance. Voting will remain open until 11:59 p.m. Monday the 30th of April. If you already voted in the first round, your vote still counts. There is no need to vote again. But if you haven't voted yet, just head over to AustralianPodcastAwards.com, click on the vote icon, and follow the instructions. Every vote counts. If you're a fan of the Australian accent, but would like to hear stories from another part of the world, then I have the perfect podcast suggestion for you. Hosted by a fellow Aussie that is based in Canada, Canadian True Crime provides a captivating look at some cases from the Great White North. And it just so happens to be a personal favourite of mine. Here's the host, Christy, to tell you all about it.
Hi, this is Christy Lee from the Canadian True Crime Podcast. Don't be put off by my weird accent. I am Australian, but I've been living in Canada for many years. My show takes a deep dive into some of Canada's most well-known cases, like Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka and Robert Picton, the pig farmer. But I also tell the complete stories of many cases you probably haven't heard of. You can find me on your favourite podcast app or social media just by searching for Canadian True Crime.
This episode of Fallon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Shards of broken glass stream down and splinter on the street below. 11 floors up, in the building above, there is a struggle. Panic, confusion, and rage courses through his veins as he thrashes from his captors to be released. His last act of violence would be against himself. The broken window is his only escape. The remaining shards of glass protrude from the frame like crooked teeth. He moves frantically as they gash his body. Blood spills from his wounds, but he is beyond feeling now. He claws his way through the razor-like pieces and kicks the hands that have been dragging him back away. Through the jagged opening, he slides out and then over the edge. His blood leaves a crimson trail of his fall along the outside of the building. 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2,
Well, as you can see, there's absolute chaos down below. Police have been caught by surprise. They're obviously doing their best. Traffic, as you can see, is just absolutely chaotic. The word from up here is if anyone can avoid coming to the city, they should do so by all means. If they do have to come to the city, they should leave it as late as possible because this traffic is going to be here for some time. Police will obviously have streets blocked into around that area where the shooting took place, the telecom building in Queen Street blocked off for ages to come yet. So the word is avoid the city at all costs this evening, and if you are travelling home, just take it as easy as possible.
In the early 1960s, Drago Vitkovic met his soon-to-be wife, Antonetta. Drago was born in Yugoslavia, and Antonetta in Italy. They met in Australia after they had both immigrated. And following their brief courtship and marriage, the pair had decided on the Melbourne suburb of West Preston to begin a new life together, where they would raise their family. West Preston, located approximately 9 kilometres north of the CBD, had become a popular destination for many European immigrants during the 50s and 60s, and the Vitkoviches soon settled in comfortably to their newfound community. In 1962, from Drago and Antonetta's union, came a daughter named Lily. And in 1965, their son, Frank, was born. The family lived in a small, white, humble weatherboard home on May Street. Their household was not seen as one that was out of the ordinary, and siblings Lily and Frank were close to each other and their parents. Their mother and father were seen as caring and supportive. Their youth was filled with fishing trips, playing billiards and laughter. There were times that Frank and Lily did not get along, but both looked back on their younger years fondly. Despite this seemingly ordinary household, it would not be long before Frank would find himself the victim of exclusion and bullying at the hands of his peers at school. Frank found himself the target of cruel taunting and soon felt isolated. On one occasion, while attending church mass, he had requested to be excused to go for a toilet break. His teacher had refused, and being unable to contain the urge, he urinated himself. With this came merciless teasing from witnesses and those who quickly heard about the incident. He was consistently exposed to mocking glances, whispers, and jokes from his classmates. From a young age, Frank had discovered what it was like to be different. On one occasion, when he was 8 years old, he was required to undress and change in a school locker room. As was the custom of the time, most boys were circumcised. When Frank removed his clothes, it was noticed by the others that Frank was not circumcised. The boys present took delight in pointing out this difference. Frank would later reflect on this occasion as the defining moment that would in turn impact his life in years to come. He would go on to write in his diary, "After this, nudity was a dirty word for me. Since the age of 12, I knew that normal sex was not possible for me, and I avoided girls completely until the age of 19. I am the odd man out, there is no doubting it." Despite this ongoing exclusion at the hands of his peers, Frank was academically successful. While at high school, at Redden Catholic College in Preston, he found himself in the top 5% of students. Frank found some consolation in this success, but it had come with a price. An obsessive personality and a competitive streak drove him to study into the early hours of many mornings. He became known as a perfectionist among his peers, with an ability to recall and share facts and figures. School acquaintances soon came to refer to him as the stats man. While at high school, Frank grew to stand over 6 feet tall, and with a solid build, his menacing frame was a far cry from a scared 8-year-old who had once stood naked and embarrassed in the change room in front of his peers. But exclusion and bullying had taken its toll on young Frank, and would always be a sore point that would weigh heavy on him. He would always feel like the odd man out. Male counterparts at school would refer to him patronizingly as Vico and Victor Dick, reiterating to him in his mind that he really was the odd man out. As well as enjoying academic success, Frank soon began to find success on the tennis court. His competitive edge drove him to practice fanatically. He would often be found at the clay courts of St. Raphael's Tennis Club, where he came to be seen as a local legend by young immigrant children who looked up to him as a role model. In 1983, his passion for tennis spurred him on to win the club championship at the age of 18. With this win came the admiration of his supporters, and in turn, a lift in his confidence. In 1984, Frank's academic journey would continue when he was offered a place at Melbourne University to study law. Again, this achievement allowed him to take pride in himself and to drown out the negativity that had plagued him throughout his younger years. But this success would only be short-lived and would soon create a ripple effect in his life. In 1985, Frank lost his title at the tennis club, and with this loss, he left the club. He had been known in the past to throw tantrums on the court when faced with losses, and this was his final straw. In 1986, his results at university were dropping significantly. He tried to keep up appearances to family and friends, but eventually, this decline led to him dropping out of university to help his father in his painting business. In 1987, he made an attempt to return to his course at university, but ceased his studies early in the same year when faced with the result of unsatisfactory progress. His lecturer had become concerned both with the low quality and disturbing content of his essays. One particular essay outlined a belief that civil libertarians should be executed. This strange submission prompted his lecturer to refer him to a university counselor. Leading up to this troubled time at university, Frank had injured his knee while running. This injury soon became inflamed by trying to play tennis. Operations to fix his knee only seemed to make it worse, and he was soon left housebound and sunk into a deep depression. He started to put on weight, stopped caring for his appearance, and became even more withdrawn and awkward around others than he had been prior. At times, he would randomly appear back at university, looking dishevelled and irritated. On the 8th of December, 1987, in the Vitkovich family home in West Preston, Frank wrote in his diary, packed a large bag with some items, and with his bag in hand, boarded the number 4 tram towards the city. Upon arriving at Melbourne University, he stopped by the Union House office to see a Mary Cook. Mary worked as the head receptionist, and Frank had made friends with her during his time studying there. She had been one of the first people to greet him when he had commenced his studies, and he would go to her with any troubles that he had while studying there. On this particular day, he felt the need to confide in her. Mary sensed that Frank was not well, and asked him how he was going. Frank mentioned to Mary that his studies had declined. He had failed 3 subjects, and in light of this, he had decided to defer for a year. Mary felt sorry for him, and suggested that she could organize for him to see a counselor. Frank politely rejected the offer, quickly adding that he had a job to do at the post office. Mary took this to mean the general post office in the city, but upon saying goodbye to Mary, Frank made the short trip into the CBD to 191 Queen Street and arrived at the entry of the Australia Post building. During his visit with Mary, she noticed that as they spoke, Frank would become distracted and continuously glance at the bag that he brought with him. As Frank stood at the front of this building, he carried with him that same bag. The Australia Post building stood 18 stories high and housed the number of businesses and offices. Frank had come to the building to see an old friend from school who worked on the 5th floor. At approximately 4 p.m, Frank entered the building, clutching his bag tightly. He made his way to the offices of the Telecom Credit Union on the 5th floor, where his friend, 22-year-old Con Majalis, had worked for the past 2 years. At around 4:15 p.m, Frank arrived on the 5th floor and approached the reception desk of the credit union and requested to see his old mate Con. The layout of the credit union was a standard bank formation. There were 5 counter tellers and an inquiry counter. The main office space was divided from the customer queuing area by these counters. Frank was served by Rina D'Arginio, and upon hearing his request to see Con, she made her way behind a partition where Con's desk was located. She informed him that he had a visitor, and he quickly made his way to the front desk to greet Frank. Upon seeing Frank, he welcomed him with a warm hello. But it would soon become clear to Con that Frank was not paying him a visit to exchange pleasantries. Frank pulled out a sawn-off M1 carbine rifle from his jacket and pointed it at his unsuspecting friend. The gun aimed squarely at him. Con called out, "You have to be joking." But without any hesitation, Frank pulled the trigger. As Con reeled backwards in shock, the only sound that came from the gun was the click of the trigger. It had jammed and failed to fire. Shani Milliken, who was located on the front desk near the inquiry counter, jumped to her feet and began to yell at Frank. She assumed it was a prank between friends, and she told him to cut it out and to put the gun down. But determined to find his mark, he started to climb over the front counter, sending Con and Shani fleeing in opposite directions, with Con yelling, "He's got a gun," as he scurried from his attacker. Con gathered with colleagues behind the counter as they ducked behind a desk by the door that led to the tellers. Along with Andrew Milivac, Kathy Woods, and Judy Morris, Con would find a temporary shelter behind this desk. Co-worker Alison Cosland had hidden herself behind a small safe located near the teller counter. With his gun now functioning, Frank began to unleash a series of indiscriminate shots in the direction of the cowering office workers. The first burst from his gun exploded a glass partition above their heads. He had now cleared the front counter and was moving in their direction. Seeing that he was heading their way, the frightened group of colleagues left the brief shelter they had found behind the desk, and in a chaotic unison, they moved in to the teller counter area with the hope of climbing over and heading for the exit. Seeing their attempt to escape, Frank climbed back over the counter and paced along the customer service area in front of the tellers, prompting the group to move back into the office space. Again, in an attempt to counteract their escape, Frank mounted the counter and began another attempt to corner them in. Again, they moved through to the teller area, and again he jumped back over into the public area to block their escape. This continued back and forth for about 30 seconds, with Frank closing in with a crazed determination. Breaking from this routine, Frank started to walk around to the back of the teller's area, towards the office door. Sensing they had to make a break for it, Con Majelis leapt onto a counter to escape, while Andrew Milivac jumped over another. As Con made his attempt to flee, Frank lined him up in his sights and fired. The rifle erupted with a crack and found the target. In the movement of the attempt to escape, Judy Morris had come to be standing between Frank and Con. When Frank had fired at Con, it was Judy who was hit and killed. Meanwhile, in another office, located beside the lift foyer, another office worker, Rita Vamer, became aware of the gunshots and commotion. She had glanced out of her office and had seen Frank with the gun. In a panic, she pressed the bank alarm button and hid under her desk.
Any unit clear for a hold-up alarm to Telecom Credit Union, 191 Queen Street in the city. For information, there are still shots being fired. Urgent, we need more units down here. Shots are fired.
Frank ran past Judy's fallen body and jumped over the counter to chase Con. While Frank was distracted, Andrew Milovac continued to the exit and down the stairs. With Frank in pursuit, Con pushed through the first doors that he came to and found refuge, locking himself inside the female toilets. With Con escaping the savage attempt on his life, Frank left the frightened workers on level 5 and made his way to the elevator. He had left one victim in his wake and was now intent on finding more. On the outside of the building, uniformed police had started to assemble, and onlookers had started to gather to try to catch a glimpse of the action. Workers in the building opposite had become aware of a commotion and had stopped what they were doing, fixing their gaze on the unfolding chaos across the road and on the street below.
I believe at this stage we've got a man with a high-powered rifle still in the building, firing shots at random at this stage. Can you get some city traffic up here to block off? We're going to clear the whole area. There's going to be problems.
Meanwhile, inside the building, Frank entered the lift and travelled to the 12th floor. On the eastern side of this floor, he came to a security door that led to the Melbourne Philatelic Bureau. He rang the bell and banged repeatedly on the door. Those visiting this office were supposed to be screened through a small interview window that was to the side of the heavy security door. In the weeks leading up to Frank's arrival, the area behind this window had become a makeshift stationary storage, making it redundant for viewing and screening potential visitors. The only way to see who was on the other side of the door was through a small bulletproof window located at head height in the security door. John Dirac was at his desk when he heard the bell ring. He made his way to the front door and peered through at Frank. Frank was standing upright with both arms by his side. Not seeing anything suspicious about Frank, John made the decision to open the door and to inquire as to how he could assist him. As soon as the door opened, Frank raised the sawn-off rifle that he concealed and fired at close range. John fell to the floor face down, and while he lay prone on the floor, Frank unleashed two more shots. John lay unmoving, but despite three close-range gunshot wounds, he still clung to life. There was around 20 staff members that shared this space that Frank had now breached, and upon hearing the shots fired, they sprung to their feet and attempted to flee within their confined space. Some ran into a storeroom. Others hid under desks. Louise Emmett and 18-year-old Nancy Avignon were among those who had seen Frank enter and had decided to hide under the desks as he moved closer. At a nearby desk, also crouched under it, was 20-year-old Julie McBean. Frank had seen movement as the workers ducked for cover, and now he was heading straight for the three frightened women. As Frank closed in on them, they could hear the clicking of him repeatedly cocking the gun, and he expressed frustration in it malfunctioning, yelling, "They expect me to kill people with this gun?" as he smashed a window in anger. With the shattering of glass and the looming threat of Frank drawing closer and closer, Julie, unable to contain her terror, screamed in a panic. Hearing this, Frank quickly approached and stood above her. With a morbid excitement, he inquired, "Who's this here?" And without waiting for an answer, he unleashed two shots at close range, killing her instantly. Frank walked past Nancy and Louise and into an office cubicle behind their desks. Here crouched 28-year-old David Spencer. Nancy and Louise heard David shout, "Please don't do this," and then two blasts from the rifle. Frank left the office space where David's body now slumped on the floor and focused his sights on Nancy. He had seen her behind her desk, and as he approached, he fired two shots from around 3 meters away. These shots were not fatal, and so he moved closer. She repeatedly screamed, "Please no, please no," but standing over her, he raised his rifle to her head and shot her at point blank.
Can you confirm he's on the 12th floor apparently?
Any indication of the shotgun?
Nah, the noise sounds like a high-powered rifle to myself.
Phone the SOG, please.
Satisfied for now with the terror that he inflicted on the 12th floor, he moved to a fire escape stairway and headed down to the 11th. Police on the ground scurried anxiously, trying to determine what exactly was happening and the best course of action.
Coming down to the 10th floor, still firing shots, still got problems.
Arriving on the 11th floor, Frank pushed through swinging glass doors that opened into the office spaces. As he entered, he locked eyes with 38-year-old Michael Maguire. Seeing the gun, Michael fled into a training room and tried to find shelter in the space behind the door. Frank made his way towards the room and peered behind the door. Realizing that he had been discovered, Michael, a father of three, pleaded with the armed stranger, "I haven't done anything to you. I won't hurt you. Don't shoot me." But Frank was beyond reasoning and again pointed his rifle and fired a single shot. Michael remained upright, supported by the wall. He was still alive. Frank disappeared for around a minute, but upon hearing Michael's cries for help, returned and fired another shot at close range. With this shot, he fell to the floor. Again, the shot was not fatal. Michael continued to plead with his attacker, repeating the phrase, "Please don't kill me. Please don't kill me." But Frank moved closer. He put the rifle to Michael's head and spoke the words, "I'm going to kill you." And with those five final words, he dispensed the fatal shot. He left the room and closed the door behind him. Michael Maguire had not been alone in the training room. Behind the now closed door, a relieved Glenn Schilling reeled from what he had seen and heard, but he took some consolation that he had remained undetected. Only moments earlier, Glenn had taken the elevator down from the 14th floor and was on his way home. He had heard what he later came to know was gunfire as he made his descent through the 12th floor. When he arrived at ground floor, he was instructed by uniformed police to return to the elevator and to make his way up to the top of the building, where he was told he would be safe. He left the elevator at the 11th floor, just in time to see Frank entering through the swinging doors. It was then that he had fled into the training room, just prior to Michael Maguire. As he hid, he witnessed the brutal attack on Michael. When Frank left the training room, he moved across the 11th floor towards the northeast corner. Many workers that had been in the open plan office space huddled under desks, behind cupboards, and in corners, and had remained there since hearing gunshots earlier on the floor above. Frank fired in the direction of the frightened group, exclaiming, "You're all scum. Well, who's laughing now? What's the point of life when nobody loves you? I'm going to take you all with me." Among the huddled office workers was Don McElroy. Frank had spotted him and moved quickly towards him with gun raised. A shot was fired and it caught Don in the shoulder. A floor-to-ceiling window behind him shattered, sending shards of glass falling to the street below. Frank continued his onslaught to seek out further victims. 38-year-old Marianne Van Ewyk was attempting to conceal herself under her desk. As Frank approached, she was shaking, and it was obvious to him that she was terrified by the ordeal that had rapidly and violently unfolded. He raised his gun to her head and said, "Not to worry, I will put you out of your misery," and fired a single, fatal shot. In the same area, Frank discovered a group that were clustered together. Rosemary Spiteri, Rod Brown, Frank Carmody, Erica Johnson, and Kathy Dowling all huddled together in shock of what they had just witnessed. Frank fired at the group. Five shots hit Kathy Dowling, and she died from her wounds. Don McElroy, who had been struck in the shoulder, was discovered by Frank to still be alive. He stood over him and said, "You're giving me a lot of trouble, fat man," and fired another shot into his body. Frank continued to fire on the group, hitting Rosemary in the head, a wound that luckily would not prove to be fatal, and wounding Frank Carmody. But those who were in the firing line were suddenly offered a brief reprieve when Frank Vitkovich, who was now playing with the trigger of his gun, screamed in frustration, "This bastard of a gun is jamming." Sensing his moment to turn the tables on their attacker, Frank Carmody, although wounded, sprung to his feet and rushed towards Vitkovich. Unjamming his gun, Vitkovich fired and shot at Carmody and sent him crashing to the floor with a gunshot wound to the back. Frank Carmody would survive his wounds, but his colleague, Rod Brown, would not be so lucky. Vitkovich made his way to the desk where Rod was crouching during the attack and shot him in the back of the head. Rod Brown would become the eighth fatality of Frank Vitkovich's merciless attack. A witness to the shooting of Rod Brown was Tony Joyer,
He had seen Vitkovich approach Rod and shoot him at close range, and figured it was only a matter of time before he too would be in the firing line. Tony crept up behind Vitkovich and, when close enough, grabbed him around the waist, wrestling with him and yelling for those around him to assist him in taking the gun from him. Frank Carmody, who had suffered 4 gunshot wounds, again saw another opportunity to turn the tables. With Tony attached to his waist, Vitkovich thrashed to get loose. His arms were free and he flailed with the gun, trying to point it at Tony. During this struggle, Vitkovich came crashing down to the floor. With Vitkovich on the ground, Frank Carmody assisted Tony and pried the gun from his hands. In getting hold of the gun, he passed it to another colleague, Emma Nixon, who was now standing nearby, ready to assist the two men. Emma took the gun and hid it in the fridge in the office kitchen. Disarmed and outnumbered, Frank Vitkovich, for the final time in his life, would find himself the odd man out. As Vitkovich thrashed to be freed, the remaining victims of his attack wrestled with him and attempted to pin him down. But Frank had now decided upon the final victim of his massacre, and he clawed his way towards the opening in the broken window. He writhed and lunged as Claire Checkley, Don McElroy, Frank Carmody, and Tony Joya sat on him and attempted to pull him back by his legs. But he inched closer and closer to the opening in the window, and with each rage-filled lunge, he would eventually shake off his captors and crawl out through the opening. He would be savaged by the broken glass, but he was beyond feeling. Frank Vitkovich dragged himself out through the opening and then over the ledge. He would fall the 11 stories to his death, becoming the 9th and final fatality of what would come to be known as the Queen Street Massacre. His time of death officially listed at 4:34 p.m., a mere 17 minutes after his attack had begun.
"The fellow's just jumped. He's dead. He's on the ground. Urgent. He's either thrown somebody out or it's the offender. I'm not quite sure. He's right in front of me. Please stand by. That person did not jump. He appeared to be leaned out of the window and there's been no shots fired since. But the person could still be inside the building. Yeah, I have a person with me from the telecom and they feel that is the offender and no shots have been fired since. Can you have a couple of ambulances on standby, please? We have injured people upstairs being shot. Just the body that's come out, got a magazine clip and bullets beside it. I've got a woman from the 11th floor. She claims they disarmed the offender. They've got a person up there that's been shot. They want medical assistance."
Waking up on the 9th floor of 190 Queen Street, and there was a first shot. Didn't take much notice, and then there was a second shot, and I noticed that one of the windows was broken across from this building, and there was some whiffs of smoke coming out. And then sometimes later, I think it's on the 10th floor of the other 191 Queen Street, there was a person who was at the window. And he was apparently either being pushed out or he was going to jump out of the building. And there were two people basically sort of holding on to him, and he was struggling and kicking, and next thing he fell, and then that was about it, really.
Those who knew Frank Vitkovich were in disbelief that the Frank they knew could be capable of such atrocities. But it would not be long before detectives would discover a personal diary that would shed light on the man who had inflicted so much carnage.
"Frank Vitkovich lived with his parents and elder sister here in this Preston home. The family were too distressed to answer media inquiries. Nick Murphy was a mate of Frank's. The two had played tennis together for 5 years.
Just amazed by it all, because he didn't seem that sort of guy to do that thing. Wouldn't have thought he'd be capable. No, no way. How does it make you feel? Pretty shocked when you know someone. Normally you just hear about it on the news, but when you actually know the person, it makes you feel, makes you wonder."
Neighbours in the normally quiet street were stunned.
It just makes you feel a bit surprised.
I was still shaking about it. That's what I was really, I couldn't believe it.
No one could believe Frank was capable of the massacre. One neighbour went into the Vitkovich family home to pay his respects. He then emerged as the family spokesman.
"I have a better word, they're totally devastated by what's happened.
Are they able to give any reason or explanation for what occurred?
No, none whatsoever. What I do know about Frank is that he was a good man, 22-year-old, easygoing sort of a bloke, had a lot of love in him. He was a top bloke. He was a top bloke.
For the relatives of the 8 dead victims, the horrible reality hit today. Most were too distraught to speak to the media. Frank Van Ewyk says the shooting of his sister Mary Ann has no rhyme or reason.
It was just senseless, you know. Those people, my sister and those people shot. You don't think anything, you know. The whole thing was just senseless, you know. Stupid.
Bernie Parry is the father-in-law of 38-year-old Michael Maguire, who was also killed yesterday on his son's birthday.
The youngest was 5 yesterday. Today his father was killed, and he was waiting at home for him to come and cut his birthday cake. And we found out at 10:30 that Michael had been shot.
Mr. Parry doesn't want yesterday's deaths to be in vain.
The government needs to do something about the gun laws, and I think they should give great consideration to bringing back the death penalty. The public has got to do something. Rise up and let the government know that this has got to stop.
Coming up in part 2.
This is a city, a society that's never experienced this sort of thing before. And I just stop and think, what more can we do? Young people, 18, 19, 20, just starting out their working life, just shot down like that. I mean, what do you do?
Mr. Hallenstein is the man at the centre of the long-term investigation into what happened in Queen Street yesterday. It's his responsibility to try to find out how, where, and if possible, why yesterday's massacre happened. As coroner, he was one of the first people to view the aftermath of the carnage inside the Australia Post building, to try to piece together the horror.
So I really had to see what was involved, so that I would say the first hour was just seeing what was a very, very complicated scene on multiple floors, multiple coroner's bodies, that really took a long time just to absorb, to put into a context of what we had to do and what our task was.
Mr. Hallenstein said already the major responses and community reactions to the shootings were similar to those at the time of the Hoddle Street massacre.
I have to consider what I'm going to do with this as opposed to the Clifton Hill matter. It's apparent that there are some very significant similarities in the matters. It's apparent that they're going to raise at least significantly similar issues. And it seems common sense that when you have two very significant events that have occurred like this, to hear the inquest into each of the deaths involving each of the incidents all in one hearing, so that the whole thing can be dealt with in one process and tackle.
Felon, true crime, the underbelly of the land down under.